من يريد الله به خيرا يفقهه في الدين.
As graduates of first grade FIC, it's hoped that we would benefit, cooperate, unite on truth, and make decisions based on proof, Quran, authentic hadith, ijtihad, qiyas, but most importantly, al-ijma', consensus of the scholars, because it includes all the other proofs. Welcome to Outlining Fiqh. We have with us today Sheikh Abu Toba and several students of Fiqh from around the world. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Sheikh, are you still with us?
Yes, astaghfirullah. I thought I hit it to turn it on. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. كيف حالكم؟
الحمد لله. I'm doing just fine. How are you, Sheikh?
الحمد لله رب العالمين.
ما شاء
الله. Where are we at today, sir?
We are in A Summary of Islamic Jurisprudence by Sheikh Saleh Fozan. And if you're following along in the English translation in the printed book, it's going to be page 327, but if you're in the PDF file, then the page number is 344, and this is Unit 5, Inheritance, Chapter 21, Inheritance by Rudd. So, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Inheritance by Rudd. According to the scholars of inheritance, the Rudd means giving the remainder of the estate, after the prescribed shares are divided, to the legal heirs entitled to prescribed shares, in case there is no agnate relative entitled to get the remainder. Allah exalted be He, stated the prescribed shares as half, one-fourth, one-eighth, two-thirds, one-third, and one-sixth, and explained how the agnate males and females inherit. The Prophet ﷺ also said what may mean, give the shares of the inheritance prescribed in the Quran to those who are entitled to receive them. Then, whatever remains should be given to the closest male relative of the deceased. This noble hadith clarifies the text of the glorious Quran and puts the heirs of both types in the right order. Those entitled to receive prescribed shares, then the agnate relatives. According to this hadith, whenever both types are involved in a case of inheritance, those entitled to prescribed shares are to be given their due shares first, and then the remainder, if any, is to be given to the agnate relatives. If there are agnate relatives only, they are to be given the whole estate, divided according to their share. The problem arises when there are persons entitled to prescribed shares whose shares of the estate are less than the amount of the estate, and there are no agnate relatives to get the remainder. In such a case, the remainder will be redistributed among those entitled to prescribed shares, in proportion to their prescribed shares, except the two spouses, according to the following proofs. First, Allah exalted be He says what may mean, but kindred by blood are nearer to one another regarding inheritance in the decree ordained by Allah. Quran, Surah Al-Anfal, Ayah 75. Those entitled to the prescribed shares are the deceased's blood relatives, so they are more entitled to the deceased's estate than anyone else. Second, the Prophet ﷺ says what may mean, if anyone leaves a property, it goes to his heirs, compiled by Al-Bukhari and Muslim. This ruling is general in all types of estate left by the deceased, including what is left over, the remainder, after distributing the prescribed shares. Thus, one's legal heirs, who are entitled to prescribed shares, are more entitled to one's estate than anyone else. Third, Sa'ad ibn Abi Waqas, may Allah be pleased with him, narrated that he said to the Prophet ﷺ while he was visiting him because he was ill, what may mean, O Messenger of Allah, I have no heirs except my only daughter. The Prophet ﷺ did not deny restricting the inheritance to the daughter. If it were impermissible, it would not be approved by the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam. This denotes that the one entitled to a prescribed share gets the remainder of the estate if there are no other agnate relatives, and this is what is meant by the rudd. The rudd is applicable with regard to the persons entitled to receive prescribed shares, except the two spouses, for they may not have a common blood relationship. Thus, the husband and the wife are not included in the general denotation of the following ayah. In English, it may mean, but kindred by blood are nearer to one another regarding inheritance in the decree ordained by Allah. Quran, Surah Al-Anfal, Ayah 75. Scholars have unanimously agreed that the two spouses are not among those who are to be given the excess of the estate. Yet it was reported that Uthman ibn Affan, may Allah be pleased with him, once judged that the remainder of the estate is to be given a husband. Scholars view that Uthman's
judgment... Meaning given to the husband.
Given to the husband. Scholars view that Uthman's judgment may have been due to a reason other than the rudd, such as being an agnate relative or having a blood relationship with his wife, and Allah knows best.
Or there not being any other person to give it to. Okay? Meaning her not having any other relatives besides the husband. Okay? So here, in this issue, people always ask, well, why not the husband and wife? What's the difference here? Well, the thing here, it always seemed to me, is it is as if at the time of the death, everybody goes back to what they were prior. Okay? Hmm. Meaning the husband and wife, the wife goes back to being her family. You know, the tribe that she came from and was born into. Or the family that she was born into, let's say it that way, the clan. In the United States, we have this small idea of a clan, which is just, you know, your mother and father and brothers and sisters. But in Islam, it's everyone under that same grandfather would be considered a clan, you know, and those are all her relatives. And so there's a return back to, you know, it's as if it's a type of divorce, you know, and even after a short period of time, 4 months and 10 days, she can remarry. Okay, So there is a clear separation and marital separation at the time of death. Okay, and for that reason, it seems, and we're assuming here, that this is why he does not and she does not get a major portion of the person's wealth. Another reason some people may assume is like this does not allow a woman to be a gold digger. You know, so some people may say they're going to marry the man and she's going to take all his estate once he dies. No, she's not. Okay? She's not. She's going to get what her due is and the rest remains in the family. So it forces sincerity in marriage from that angle as well, if that makes sense. So Islam has so many protections. In here, and so many clarifications. I see it as a clarification so that, you know, the husband and the wife go back to being who they were. And all the benefit that the wife got from the husband, you know, and this is an assumption, meaning that in normal cases, the wife, she works for the husband in the home and doesn't have a job which is paying her a salary. But it's paying her for Jannah, and he's buying her gifts, and inshallah, let's say he's wealthy, she amasses some type of wealth and jewelry and these things like that. Well, if she has children, then her children are going to get those things, okay? And her brothers and sisters are going to get the benefit of that, of their sister now, okay?
Wait, I'm not following you, Sheikh. Are you saying that if the husband gives his wife a gift upon his death, it goes to someone else?
No, I'm saying that if the husband gives the wife a gift upon her death.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
You know, her the things that she has amassed now gets divvied amongst her relatives. Okay, it doesn't go back to him. right? It goes back to her relatives, whether it be her children, her brothers or sisters, or her parents if they are still alive. You understand?
Nam. I understand now.
Are there any questions about this?
Yes, I wish I had an example. I wish you gave us an example in the text, because I don't understand how the proportions. It says that he, it says that you redistribute what's left in proportion to the prescribed shares, but you don't include the spouse. So how does that work?
Okay, so well, you know, whatever the spouse is going to get that 1/6, let's say the spouse gets, but let's say there's a whole bunch left over, and then there's only these relatives, then they would distribute it amongst themselves. And this is why you have the executor of the state to make these determinations. Okay? Let's say there are the females and males, then it would be the same thing. The male would get twice the size of the woman.
Okay.
You get my point?
Yes. Yeah, so basically, it's like you're...
Remember I said earlier that even in so many cases we've had, whereas the people involved or the executor of the state has to make certain determinations. Some people travel there and they're not mentioned and they're not getting a portion because they were of the rule of hijab. But he distributes something to make sure he covers their travel expenses, let's say. You know, the executor of the state does that. You know, these are things that he's allowed to do. You get my point?
Yes, sir.
And like we said, when the brother or someone dies in a crash or something like that, or just newly dies, and then someone else dies right after him, then or he's missing, right? And he's assumed dead at that time. Or so they might still give his portion to his wife and daughters and children. You know, these are things that the executor of the state can finagle. Okay, it's not taking away from anyone else's rights. So if there's some portion that can be finagled to make sure everyone gets something, and the money is there, the wealth is there, then why not make it so that they get it? The whole, remember what the objective is to make sure that the relatives receive and inherit the wealth of their relatives. Okay? And so this wealth stays as, what are we going to call it? You know, family wealth, family turaf.
It stays in the family. Okay?
Right, stays in the family. And this is your reward for having a wealthy family member, right? How many, look at the people we see in the world nowadays. Just take the United States, for example. And there are so many wealthy entertainers and, you know, fools, you know, the clowns for the court and stuff like that, and actors. And they amass a lot of wealth. But people don't realize when they die, unless they've had a trust or something, their relatives don't get anything.
Wow.
You know, they don't get anything. Remember when Bush was the president? I think it was Bush or Reagan or something like that. It was Bush beer. His brother was making commercials for beer. Commercials, just a bum in some place. I think it was Arizona. No, it was Clinton. I think it was his brother. But the point is that, yo, just because you're the president and your brother's over here, a wino on the street, okay? There's no family in the United States. There's no family laws and tradition demanding you take care of your family. And if they're demanding the family is together, everyone is individualized. But the individual is easily conquered, right? Divide and
yes, sir.
Rule is the thing. But with families, you can't do that.
Nah, what's Does the that saying? Something about the lone sheep gets devoured by the wolf?
The sheep furthest from the herd is the one that's attacked by any of the animals of attack. Any of the muftarisun, the those animals that are attackers, right, carnivores, they always get the one that's the furthest from the, on the outskirts of the herd. Okay, but when they're together, then they have to surround it. They run around it looking for a weakness, looking for a straggler. Okay? And you can look at that. If you look at those wildebeests and you look at some of those other big oxen, when even a lion comes and attacks one of theirs, they turn around and come back. And the lion runs. Okay? Because together, those bulls will knock that lion high in the sky, right?
Nah, that's right.
So, yeah, they'll throw him right up in the sky and bang him up and bust his ribs up and everything like that, wind up stomping him. They don't play that. You know, and that's because there's strength in numbers. And Islam has come to preserve and protect, prioritize it, and always respect my deen, my mind, my wealth, my honor. So by having a jama' hakadha, the way Allah has designed family, your honor is preserved. Your honor is preserved. You know, I'll give you an example of this in modern day times. In the United States, when people, let's say they riot or they come out and they showing a protest, the police do what? They go and they arrest everybody. Not everybody, but they arrest some people. They charge those people too. Ruin their lives to some degree. Send them to jail, you know, and the people have a righteous reason for protesting. They tried that in Egypt. In Giza, they ran the people off the land, telling them this is going to be a resort now for Europeans. And the people are like, hold on, we've been living here for 1,000 years. Okay, since the Jews left with Fir'aun. And you're telling us you're taking our land? And they protested and, you know, said, nah, we're trying to pull in the tractor tailors or whatever the construction equipment. Oh, you guys are violating the people, the construction workers stuff. They arrested a whole bunch of people. The people in that town rioted. They stormed the police station. Women, everybody. Stormed the police station, crowded in there, fought the police. Nobody was shot because the police have some humanity there. But they fought these people, got the keys, and freed their relatives from the local precinct. Okay? Wow. Says, you're not arresting these. No way you're going to send these guys to no prison. You're out your minds. Okay? That they stormed the place. It's a bunch of farmers, you know? Why? Because they got family. No way you're going to leave us out here without our men, without our uncles and fathers and everything like that. No. It's a woman. Okay? And most of them were women and older men. You know?
No.
We don't do that in America. We're domesticated. Oh, please, sir, let him come out. Oh, you'll see him at court. Hell, I will. I'll see you in hell. You know? But that mentality is, oh, you're dangerous. No, you're dangerous. Okay? Some things are worth fighting for. Right? And they always tell you that when you're in the military, but not when you're a civilian. I can go to Iraq or some other place and go fight for justice for some people in Ukraine, methylene, but I can't do it for myself. This is the American double talk.
No, that's right. And Sheikh, also, my wife told me that during the pandemic in the Qatar masjid, in the main masjid there, they tried to close the masjid during the pandemic, and the people stormed the masjid. And like just like that, it was mostly women, like older people and women, and they opened the masjid that way.
That's right. You know, you can't. You're gonna stop. Who's stopping us from praying? Allah gave us permission to pray. We don't. You don't have authority to stop me from praying. That's paramount to kufr, right? You're gonna stop me from the house of Allah? On whose authority? Some kafirs? You know what I'm saying? Some untrustworthy kafir? No. No, no, no. So, you know, this is, and I've read some cases in Islamic law during the time when we had Khalifa, where some of the generals were were trying to solve cases that happened, and the only thing they had were witnesses from Kufar, and they were never accepted. It was like their witness can only be supportive. It can't be, you know, instructional. I mean, it can't be definitive. Okay. If their witness was the only witness, it's not accepted. Why? Because he's a kafir. Okay. And the usul with him is he's a liar.
Wow.
Okay. Whereas the believer,
SubhanAllah, the usul with him when is I that first became Muslim, I thought that was so harsh. Like, I thought that was so harsh that how can you say that this person's testimony is not accepted or we don't listen to them? Or however they put it back then. I thought that was crazy, Sheikh. But now, the usul is that they are liars.
How much they have learned, right?
The usul is that they have gathered together to lie against me. Like, they are liars.
Right.
I'm gonna be quiet. Isn't that is beyond like the truth of that. It is so deep that you can't even.
I have a minute till you experience it.
The gaslighting and that they come together and gaslight you is beyond. I mean,
it's like automatic comprehension. Like they don't even realize
it's what
they're
default.
Doing.
It's their
it
default.
It is their default.
And what happened in Texas Palestine. Just now? Or
can we
where
say
is it?
Can we say Palestine? Africa? Can we say Native
yes.
Americans?
Yes.
Can we say any
yes.
situation you name, they yeah. make it seem as though they are the victims and everybody
Wallah.
Else
Wallah.
Is dangerous.
Wallah. Wallah. A 6 foot something man tried to make me 5'1" look dangerous. Yes. Agreed.
Right.
Yes.
That's wow. their awesome. So, alhamdulillah.
A Muslim man would even be ashamed to do that.
No, but you know
like,
what
kind of man am I?
I will tell you what, we've lost a lot of manhood because now we have these Muslim men and they look like a bunch of sissies and they are acting just like they look. You know, they are tough towards the Muslims and gentle towards the kuffar.
One of the people that could have helped me with this is a Muslim from Iran. But when I look at what they did to Hassan and Hussein, I'm like, well, yeah, he's from Iran. So,
yeah, but all of them didn't do that. You know,
he punked out. He did not.
Yeah, but I don't think it's because of what he did to Hassan and Hussein.
You know how those Egyptians say they lived in the land from the time of Pharaoh? Yes. One of the things I learned from my sheikh is that there are family. Like, and in DNA, you pass DNA down and personality travels with it.
Yes, yes.
There are family, there are things that you learn that are in a family and in a tribe.
Yeah, Allah says it.
They were known for at the talking big and bad and at the last minute flipping. They were known for that.
That region was known.
That's what I mean. I'm not just one state. I mean, those people, I don't know which tribe he's from. But that region, they talk so big, they tell them to come.
Yeah, they were known for being backstabbers. They were known for being backstabbers. That comes in all the books of history that this was their description.
It's their way.
Yeah, that they were known for. And he gave them credit or Abbas did, you know, and they sold them out before and they even laughed at them. They were even there laughing when they showed up. You know, alhamdulillah, I'm laughing while they stood with the ones that were killing them, you know. But, you know, alhamdulillah, I don't want to get into the situation of Maqtal al-Hassan al-Hussein, the death, the murder, and the treachery that was committed against the grandsons of Rasulullah.
No, I'm just making a reference that some of those may not be non-men. They just might be these treacherous ones, whoever they are, whether they're Iranian or not. You know, there's treachery, there's weakness.
I think there's another thing here that as you're saying it as a characteristic that could be in a family or in a person, I'm saying that we've reached an era. See, there's a thing that comes in the Sharia, in the Qadr of Allah. Well, I shouldn't say the Qadr, in Iman, in the chapters of Iman. 1/6 of the Iman is belief in the last day. Amongst the signs of the last day is the loss of the amana, meaning that trust is gone. It loses. And then on the last day, when the Jahannam is brought forward and the path is put between over Jahannam, amana will be on one side of it. Will be on one side of the Sirat. Okay? So it'll show up on one side of the path as people are falling into Jahannam. And I think that's because those who lost the amana will be pulled off in that side into the Jahannam. You know, and then the Prophet ﷺ will be at the end of the Sirat saying, Allahumma ammin, ammin. Oh Allah, make it safe, make it safe. Sallam, sallam. Make it safer, make it safe. And people are going to have to cross that path, you know. And with amana on one side, those who violated it, may Allah protect us from being violators of amana. Loss of amana is a sign of the last day. So when you find men, a majority or a healthy portion of the Muslims not having an amana, this shows you how close we are to the last day, the end of time. When men lose the amana, the ability to hold to an amana. So, you know, there were certain things that just weren't done even 20 years ago from amongst men. Okay? Just certain things that weren't done. Wouldn't happen in front of men because they were men.
La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah.
And now we have a generation of males who don't even know what it means to be a man. Okay? Let alone violating the amana, they don't even know it. They're unaware of the amana of manhood. I mean, is that fair to say?
Absolutely, but that's, again, we know why that is as far as our communities. Because I see my sons, and I see real men. I see that they're real men, but I have my husband who's a real man.
And yeah, okay, well,
that's the problem. They see men, they become men, because I watched that process. Because I grew up in a single parent home, so I didn't understand what it meant just for a man to see a man being a man and what that did for these boys. Like, and it's okay, like, and I'm constantly counseling women.
And I grew up in a home where my parents are still married after 60 plus years. Yeah. And I never knew what it was like not to have a man around.
Right.
You see? So yeah. I couldn't understand because I didn't see all my uncles and everybody is married. Okay. Yeah. And I didn't see any. I never in my life have ever seen my parents and or my uncles arguing with their wives. Never. I've never seen it.
Yeah, yeah, okay? It's even now, if I'm there's sure some arguing adult, happening,
now that I'm
it's still better to keep your husband.
And now that I'm an adult, I realize how impacting that is and how difficult and how intentional that must have been for them.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Because, like I said, I have never in my life seen them argue, any of them. At the most, I've seen my mother do some outbursts and say what she's going to say, you know. But I never saw my father respond in a negative way. I never saw my father or heard my father raise his voice and yell at my mother, let alone hit her or threaten her. Nothing. He was super easygoing about it. And I never heard my aunts and aunts talk crazy to my uncles, or my uncles talk crazy, or even them argue back and forth. So, and I have 12 aunts and uncles from just my mother's side, and I have 4 from my father's side.
And then look what you've accomplished in the world. Look what you've been able to do. And that's a class that needs to be taught. One of the things that I got very upset about being a Muslim woman was it seemed like every time people talked to us in the community or to women about men being men, it was about how much we needed to accept polygamy. And I said, I don't want to hear anything else about polygamy until y'all start treating the women right and build some institutions. When we have schools and mosques and everything else, then you can come talk to me about polygamy again. Because one of the things that actually attracted to me Islam was polygamy, because I thought, oh, if there's polygamy, I would have had a father. But when I got into Islam, what I saw was the misuse of polygamy, gross misuse, widespread gross misuse of polygamy as a new form of pimpology is what I call it.
Hey, what did you say that last part? I didn't hear it.
It was a new form of pimpology. They just took the pimpology transferred it over to polygamy. And they weren't building institutions. They're just running through women. Those women were now left with children. They're still by themselves with these children. They will just leave the first wife with however many kids or have all four wives on welfare. And they still weren't building institutions. So I'm like, what are you doing?
But you know why that was?
And I saw this all over the country because I lived all over the country.
Listen, this is why that was. And I've studied that phenomenon as well. It's part of the transfer from Kuf to Islam. If you look at the Tatars, the Mongols, when they first came to Islam, they were still drinking alcohol. And they were still killing Muslims when they first came to Islam. It takes about 50 years. I was documenting it. It takes about 50 years. For us to go, for a people to go from straight kufr to now being multezimun generational Muslims with Muslim traditions inside the family. And the reason for that is in 50 years, you have three generations. You have the ones that accepted Islam. Remember, the ones that accepted Islam first were all adults. Okay? Then there's our generation. Dr. Maisha, where we accepted Islam as young people. Okay? Then there's the ones that come 10 years after that. Those guys who are there, who are 40 now, 30s now, and those guys, most of them were born Muslim. Okay? No. Now, even though they were born Muslim, it doesn't mean they had a perfect Islamic home, but they grew up with a mentality that I am Muslim. Now, we've had a lot of fall-offs, but the ones that have remained and the ones that come back, they're producing children who have nothing in their hearts except for Islam. Okay?
I agree with you. I agree with you.
Right. Those are 20 right now. We're Muslim. Their Islam may be wiki-wiki-whack right now, but those times, they're going to produce children who are going to say, no, let's go back to the traditions that we have.
Yeah.
You know? And
but this is what needs to be taught. This is what needs to be taught, that about when I see the men doing teaching, even teaching the women or teaching the groups, like my sheikh was the first sheikh. Yes, he talked a lot about polygamy. It used to drive me crazy. But he had so many lectures about, how can you even yell at a woman? How could you even fight with a woman? If you're a real man, why would you have to get her in line by fighting with her? How do you have to fight with her to get her in line and you're a man? He was the first chef I heard talk about that. African, born generations going back.
Listen, Dr. Maisha, the point is the dysfunction in a Kafir society may not be understood a lot of times by people who didn't grow up in that dysfunction. Like, I look at the self, I'm born and raised in America, just like you, right? But I grew up in a very sane, very, very functional family. But I see that Allah made me go to jail for no crime, right? I learned so much about Black people in jail. And I'm a Black man, right? There was so much I didn't know about Black people's life because I didn't grow up in that lifestyle. You know, I grew up Black and privileged. So really, I thought, yeah, I'm down. I'm from Brooklyn, you know, but no, I'm from Flatbush. I'm from Brooklyn College. it's not the same thing. You know, a lot of people don't realize, you know. So I think that experiencing that helped me understand how far the dysfunction is and how deep it is in the American society. Black, white, Latino, Those are the main groups. But the ones that are coming up now are Indian and when I say Indian, Hindu, Indian, and African and Arab and all these other groups that are so many that we're now minorities in those groups. You know? So when we were growing up, it was mainly white, black, Latino. And then the Asian community, which really kept to themselves. And that's how they preserved their sanity. And the Asian community is still the most productive community in the United States. You can look at all the stats. And the reason why they say that is because they have three generations in one house. Their grandmother lives there. Their grandfather lives there. The uncles live there. Their cousins live there. You know? So they have they're not affected by peer pressure because they're getting peer pressure from the uncle, the aunt, and the brothers and sisters and their cousins and their parents. Okay?
No. Sheikh, also
we don't have that because our grandparents, some of them, crazy as hell, or were dying because of, you know, the poor, you know, health things that they did in young age and things like that. So or crack came and destroyed our community, and we lost trust amongst each other. And because of other dysfunction, like, you know, the rampant rape and between even in-laws and even blood relatives, so it wasn't a safe environment. So now as we get a safer environment, a home, we're able to build and bring to life these children, and our experiences with dysfunction helps us protect our children from those things and teach them about it. Yeah, we might have gone through a couple of marriages finding the right one, but that in and of itself helps us when we start looking for wives and husbands for our daughters and sons.
Yes.
You know, we know what we know the triggers, we know what to look for, you know, when we see it. And we're gutsy enough to do something about it. Okay, so I think that there's a reason why everybody goes through what they go through. I think what we went through, and you got to remember too, you and I are born during Jim Crow apartheid. So that change in the United States was experienced while we were growing up. The change from segregation to integration, we actually went through that whole process. That's a historical legacy that can be articulated to the youth who think that that was prehistoric times, you know? And even people like, let's say, I really think that Toguro would be too young to even have understood or experienced that. You know, that phenomenon. Because it was the time frame, everything changed so quickly. So there's a lot to say, I think, that I don't think that Westerners, especially those in the United States, are giving themselves credit for all the progress that we've made as a Muslim nation, external, physically. And there's another thing, too, I want to add. Another difference between the Muslims in the West and the Muslims in every other place in the world is proximity to the world, to the active world. Everyone else can pretty much walk to you know, a Muslim neighboring country or walk to Mecca. Everybody. When the French raided Mali, what did the ulama do? They killed 2,000 ulama that first couple of days. Some of them ran to the hills and walked to Mecca. This famous story, this one Sheikh Hamad al-Ansari, he walked here because him and a couple of guys, they were fleeing from the French slaughtering the Shi'a. I have known people who came from Uzbekistan, people who came from Albania, you know, their grandparents, I'm saying, during different times, they were able to do that. We can't. Unless we go over to Bering Strait, right? We can't do it.
That's right.
I have friends from Russia who drove to come make Umrah. You're driving from Russia? Yeah, you can do that. We can't. So their proximity to other Muslim lands helped give them examples and had them mixing with Muslims in a you know, socially dynamic way that we didn't get to experience. So we had to go through the cults. We had to get these experiences through the different cults, the Nation of Islam, Noble Drew Ali, Hebrew Israelites, and all these other cults and Salafi cults and all these other different weirdo groups that, you know, sprouted up and had some semblance of Islam, but at the same time had some weirdo non-Islamic or un-Islamic principles, you know? And now we're able to call out what is workable and what is truly from the Sunnah and have an endearment to it, because we see that other stuff don't work, you know? And then as we start to have roots in other places, because of our children marrying in different places, now that's going to enhance our practice of Islam even better than everybody else. Why? Because we're not marrying our neighbors. We're marrying all over the planet. Okay? Look, Toguro is in Philippines. My daughter is married in the Gambia. I live in Mecca. You get my point? Your son is in the Senegal. We're all over the planet. You know? And this is just the three of us right here. So alhamdulillah, I believe that this is going to have an international effect on Islam as it's practiced in those places and Islam as it's practiced in the United States. You know, and that's just my opinion. I think that the United States is probably going to become an Islamic state, or one of the states is going to become highly Islamic, if not fully Islamic. You know, and I think that's going to be a problem for the United States, but it's going to be something they can't shake. You know, I think there's going to be some strongholds of Islam in the United States, especially when the white guys finally accept Islam on a like a larger scale. Okay, it's going to be really problematic for them.
Okay? Yeah, I've noticed that they've stepped up just in the past couple of days. I've noticed that they've stepped up their demonizing of Islam to white people specifically.
Yeah, they have to, because they see that there's a lot of white guys coming to Islam. If you look at the most prolific du'at nowadays in the United States and even in England, there's a lot of white guys in there. There's about a third of them are white guys. You know, what are you going to do when white guys hears another white guy talking, he knows his voice off the bat. Oh, hey, that's a white guy. Let me hear what he's talking about. And they start listening to that, and it makes sense. He says, hold on. First thing you talk to anybody that's a Westerner, it's about his rights. My wealth, my right. Well, you're right. I got you. And then once that kicks in, you know, that becomes very problematic. And they have to demonize. And that's why this thing that they just did now with the black guy that, you know, ran into the people in New Orleans, they're going to try to use that as a jumping suit to say, "Hey, watch out for black Muslims."
Yeah,
you know, they're the worst thing since, you know, since they're the worst
Wait,
thing.
He since said he's black. I thought he was Afghan.
Well, they over here they're saying, and right here they're saying he's a black American.
well, either way, his last name is Jabbar, Muslim.
Maybe it is.
He's Muslim either way. That's the point. They're going to try to stir up people against Islam again. May Allah save us from that.
Yeah,
may
that
Allah
the whole,
put their plots back in their throats.
I wasn't even sure if it was real. Like, I'm like, is this even real or is this a plant? Who put the ISIS flag on a Ford pickup truck that they rented? Like, it's not even, the whole story just stinks
yeah.
to me. It stinks of COINTELPRO.
That's another whole subject. Whether they're wagging the dog or not, it doesn't make a difference now because the people believe it. Even in 2 years when they tell you that it wasn't true, then it's already too late. Okay, who's to say this guy wasn't a test tube baby? You know, if you guys remember, a couple of years ago, there was a rock concert. And at the rock concert, a guy took into a corner window at the hotel with a 50 cal and killed over 100 something people. You guys remember that?
Was that in Las
Absolutely.
Vegas?
Absolutely. And I don't think they called him a terrorist, right? Because wasn't he a white guy?
Because he was a test tube baby.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, MK yeah, that Ultra. Means he don't got no soul.
He was a MK test Ultra. Tube baby.
Yeah.
Not only that, he wasn't in the military, but he was a military contract, meaning he was raised on base.
Wow.
Meaning he's owned. They made him. They made him, they bred him, and he ran off campus. Okay? He had zero relatives. He only had one wife. And she was from the Philippines.
Oh,
okay.
I didn't know all this. He was actually like he didn't have a family or anything. He was raised nothing. By the military?
He was straight military, test tube baby, no parents, nothing. Owned by the military.
Wow.
Okay? So he's all those test tube babies they made in the 70s, you think they stopped making them in the 70s? Where are they? What are they doing? Okay? Same thing when you find that guy who were at the Black Lives Matters, those three guys, or that one guy that was shooting and killing all those cops. That dude was awesome. He was gunning those guys. And one man destroyed the police. They have him on camera. He runs around a pole, turns back around, yeah. Runs the other way, pops a cop in the face. A guy puts his camera from the roof over. He, in a blink of a second, he catches him with his peripheral, spins up, pow, almost shoots the camera out of the guy's hand. I said, man, this guy is good. I said, as a military, this guy is on automatic. You can't tell me this guy is so civilian. What did they do? They had, first they said they couldn't find no relatives. Then they rushed and got it out the paper. You didn't hear nothing more about this guy. He kills these cops, but you don't know his name today, do you? You can't name him.
I don't know. I don't know, okay? What story you're talking about, Sheikh. I'm not familiar with this.
It was in Dallas. You can look it up.
Okay, I'll look
he
it up.
He was in Dallas. They had a Black Lives Matter protest. He showed up and started killing people. Okay? And now they won't. They found him a sister. Oh, they had some woman come on. Oh, I'm his sister. He wasn't like this. Da, 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 da. No other relative. Okay? Then they wouldn't talk about his military, nothing. I said, that dude's a test tube baby. That dude is you know. These, where did they get these guys that disappear? Why didn't they push out the thing about the guy who killed all those people at the hotel? Shot down on them while they were watching the concert. Whole bunch of people he kills. You don't hear nothing about. They got it out the paper really fast.
Yeah.
Okay.
May Allah foil all their plots and just smash right, their plots so, back know, down their throats.
But you're going to hear Jabbar for the rest of your life. Okay, he's going to be up there. And you're going to be afraid of every, you know, person with the jet. Jabbar, you go to the airport. Jabbar, come over here. You know, astaghfirullah
al-azim. Yep. Yeah, it's what's going to happen. But I told Moses, this is going to be our generation's, this generation's 9/11. Because they need a new 9/11. It's been more than 10 years. They need a new 9/11. They yes. have to try to make people afraid of Islam. Everybody, even yeah. white people, even gay people, are protesting on behalf of Muslims in Palestine. So, and yeah. everybody knows we don't rock with that. So what are they going to do? They have to. I was listening to the FBI agent talk. I was like, she's lying. Her voice did not sound, she knows something and she's lying. Like you could just hear it.
Hmm.
Like it was just, but yeah, it's alhamdulillah, it's our own fault because we don't put fear in their hearts anymore.
No, because we have no organizational. The reason why, well, we put fear in their heart, but we don't have a government to do so. There's no.
That's what I mean. They're not afraid yeah. if it's in a sane kind of civilized kind of way. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. When I was growing up, people were afraid of Muslims. If somebody heard you were Muslim, they're like, oh, yeah, don't mess with. I think I told you guys this. I was able to walk in any gang neighborhood. I was so dumb living in L.A., I didn't know you weren't supposed to mix red and blue. I have a blue hijab, a red, big red flannel shirt, three times my size. To boot, my clothes were oversized. I didn't know you only wore oversized clothes to hide your back. I didn't know none of that. I just knew that was the cheapest clothes and it was covered because we didn't have Jabali.
Jilbabs weren't around. You couldn't find
Jilbabs. You couldn't get Jilbabs on Temu shipped to your house back then.
No.
So.
There wasn't no stores.
You couldn't find any of that. Stores. You know, she either made your clothes and when you had to buy clothes, so I would wear those big khakis. I have on blue khakis, red flannel shirt. Anybody from the West Coast understands the meanings of these things. And a blue Kmart. Yeah, yeah. And I would walk from a Crip neighborhood to a Blood neighborhood to a Crip neighborhood. All the gangsters would open the doors for me. Nobody messed with Muslims. Nobody. Wow. A Muslim woman, I could walk freely all over the hood in L.A. Any place that was good in L.A., no problem. They treated me like royalty.
And just to tell you, show you one time, I had a blue truck. Somebody loaned me a blue truck when I was in L.A. And I was driving. I'm trying to forget, remember the neighborhood, but it's a blood neighborhood going out towards the airport. And when I got in that neighborhood and stopped at a light, all these guys were like, yo, man, what you doing? Yo, what you doing driving through that car through here? I couldn't even drive the car. I was like, yo, hold on, brother. And I had to show, I'm Muslim. They're like, yo, man, you get a pass, but don't come through here with that car no more. Don't drive through this neighborhood. I was like, subhanAllah.
Yeah, you got a pass because you were Muslim. If you weren't Muslim, right. There would have been no pass.
They would have said,
and we don't have that anymore. When I tell people, like some people, they're like, they have a Muslim story of what a Muslim did them dirty.
Mm. Yeah, I'm about to say now, and see, this is the thing, like I said, that we have had some bad publicity, and I'm not trying to attack the new immigrants, but it's mainly because of them. Okay, mainly because of the racism
that
a lot of the immigrants come to the States with towards black people and brown people. And they scoff at them. Or deception.
Like, I think a lot of the ones that ran over here before all these wars got prevalent were the ones who couldn't make it in the Muslim countries because they were criminals. But the people don't understand.
I think a lot of people ran when they had an opportunity. Some people ran. Some of the families ran because they just didn't want to be part of that, and they were able to get out, whether they had money or they were able to get education and get out. And because the United States wasn't giving you a visa unless you could bring something to the table for them. So, but the thing about it is they weren't the religious elite. That was the thing. And so
a lot of them
come over with a mentality like, okay, you are a nigger. Okay. They may not call it to your face. But they'll treat you like that. And when the non-Muslim, because the Muslim sees it and he gives you a pass because we're all Muslims. But they complain to people like me about it. But then the non-Muslim, when he sees it, he's like, F all of you guys. Forget all you Muslims. And then all the work that the guys did in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s to get street credibility and to get, the respect of the street has been lost.
Sheikh, I have a question.
But do you understand what I'm saying here?
Yes, sir. Yes. I understand.
In the 80s and the 70s, that same type of masjid would have had a soup kitchen every Wednesday or every Monday and Thursday.
Absolutely.
Or even Friday.
Fed the people and took the neighborhood kids in and let them play, encouraged them to come play.
And
so those kids would have become Muslim.
They would have had a league there. And they would have told them, hey, when you guys finish, come over here and get something to drink. And if you guys want some money, clean up the back part over this masjid over here. And it would have encouraged some of those young boys to look at the Muslims as protectors, as a place to go when something bad happens. I remember even in Florida, when I lived in Florida, sometimes I would go to take my whole family on Thursday to the masjid because I didn't have enough money to eat. So I said, let's go to the masjid on Thursday so we can break our fast because we know everybody's going to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thing when you know you can depend on the Muslims. And like I was saying, when I was growing up, about one third of the masjid for Jumu'ah were kuffar.
Okay, I remember you saying that before.
Yeah, there was a healthy portion of the people at Jumu'ah that were not Muslim. Why were they there? They're there because they want to hear too. And they felt that they had a right to be there. And they did. And they wanted to hear. And the message included them. It didn't exclude them. And then we come up with this super, this ostracizing, this pushing off, this,
Sanctimonious.
Sanctimonious
attitude that tells people I'm better than you. And Allah has taught us that this is the first sin. This is what Shaitan did with Adam. And when humans do it, it doesn't bring humanity. It doesn't bring people together. It just divides. All it does. And so we've lost some of that and we need to get that back. And in the absence of that, it becomes easier to criminalize the Muslims. It becomes easier to get enemies towards Islam in general and the adherents of Islam in particular.
Yeah.
And that puts us in danger, this mentality. But this sectarian, ethnic-based Islam is what's driving the communities. Now you have communities where they've tried, and to some degree, they've taken over, and now they're running the community like a little despot, you know, dictatorship. Okay? And now you have no say. You can't say anything, or we'll kick you out the masjid. And this wasn't the case when people got there. It was, hey, how you doing, brother? Whoever can recite the most Quran, let him lead the salah. And, you know, we had a misunderstanding about who was, if your name was Muhammad or Abdullah or anything like that. You know, when we met people whose actually name was Muhammad, we're like, oh, subhanAllah, your name was Muhammad. Actually, subhanAllah, you was rock star. Okay? You were a rock star. You know, you memorized Juz'amma. SubhanAllah, you were the imam. Okay? So we had this utopian view of Islam and the Muslims. The utopian view of Islam still stays, but the Muslims, we have to learn that are just as human as the rest of us, make as mistakes as everybody else. But our thing is now, we have to limit the harm of those mistakes as they relate to the Muslim community at large, and not allow that to give a negative impression to the rest of the world about what Islam actually is and what it stands for. And that's what this is upon us to focus on to some degree. While at the same time, we can't put all the immigrant population in one bag, because their children are not immigrants. Their children are mutants. They're stuck between two worlds. Okay? And they're going to define themselves. And have we given them knowledge enough to make good choices? Because a lot of them have what we would call a naive understanding of Islam as well. Everything's been told to this raspberry, you know, strawberry generation that everything, you have so many rights and everybody's against you and don't let this happen and they shouldn't tell you this. And so now that's general for all of them, the Muslims and the non-Muslims. How is this affecting the Muslims? You know, how is it affecting the Muslim children, the Muslim men, the Muslim women? And are they looking to get married?
Oh, there's gay. I was there's another masjid I won't mention that I was running the youth program. And one of the ways they tried to, like, I just was like, I'm done. I got too much to do. But one of the ways they somewhat halted it, there were actually rainbow girls that I challenged this. There was an Egyptian family, I think it was. And their daughter was coming with that stuff. And I was like, no, this is haram. And they got upset with me. Everyone got upset with me because I'm saying this stuff is haram. I'm like, what are you talking about? And it was a lot of immigrants at that mosque. I was like, y'all are bugging out. The girls were upset with me.
This is their, you know, it was the same thing in the 80s. In the 80s, I would see a lot of these people not telling their daughters that they had to cover. Oh, you don't have to cover. Oh, you don't have to cover. You know, and we say, okay, you saying that till she comes home and with Bobby, oh, you fahish, Abu Talib. I'm not fahish, you fahish. You are an extremist. Because remember back in the 80s when they were doing all those, honor killings, you know, every couple of years.
Yeah, I remember they used to sell, you hear some crazy stuff about that. Yeah.
You know, here it is, you saying, oh, you let her go outside without no cover, but then when she come home pregnant or not a virgin or with some dude, some capital, now you want to kill her. You know what I'm saying? Now you want to wrestle her down at 16 years old and make her wear a wool kimar.
Was this taking place in America, Shay?
Yes, I'm talking about America, United States, bro.
What?
You know?
Yeah. What's happening? Yeah, because that deeply damages the family honor. Once one girl does that, nobody wants to marry a girl from that family if they find out about it.
My point was, you go from one extreme to the next.
And that's the problem. They raised them to be super American, and then we get upset when they acted American. You can't have it both ways.
That's right.
We're going to have an interfaith. We're going to have an interfaith, Abu Talib. Are you going to come? I says, no, I'm not going to come. You know, I came one time because I didn't know what it was. And then it was like, okay, we're going to debate about Islam. Okay, if you have some questions, I'll answer them. I'm not debating. I'll answer any questions. And then we said, well, after this, we're going to have a dance. I said, hold on, what do you mean going to have a dance? Who's dancing with who? Oh, all these guys brought their daughters to dance with these Kafir boys. I said, you must be kidding me, right? You telling me you brought your daughter? Well, let me dance with her, brother. I said, and see, no, me, I'm bugged out. I told him, well, let me dance with her. You know? Oh, I was talking, you know, no, why they get to choose? And why, you know, how much are you charging? They were like, oh, be lagging in the shit. Yo, you know, if you pamper them out like that, I'll take one. They was embarrassed by that. You know? Because, you know, that they don't like to see what it actually is. You're right. Telling me you're bringing your daughters over here to dance, to bump and grind with these Kaffir guys because of interfaith. You're crazy. You're out your mind. You know? And I'm just saying it. I don't want your daughter, but I want you to think about what you're saying. And if you're giving it to Kaffirs, why don't you give them to us? I used to be a Kaffir. Hey. You know, maybe. You know, one brother.
It would make more sense, yeah.
One lady, she came and she had no cover. She wasn't covered up. You know, she wears like a see-through things like they do on the news. Like these girls put it on top of their head. Like they're trying to be so nice to Islam. They're putting on a fake kimar. She came up in there with that. And the brother said, oh, your wife looks so pretty, man. Wow, mashallah, you know. Dude got super duper angry. And he's like, what are you talking about? You know, took a look at my, I thought you want everybody to see it. You got her out here like that. You know, that's why, you know, all the people that don't want their wives to look at they, that's what they cover. You know, but since you already know that, because, you know, you're from Yemen, you know that, right? But so you brought her in, you know? Dude walked away, took his wife, left. Good, peace.
You know? Sheikh.
As they say, if you don't want nothing to eat, don't go in the kitchen. Okay? You can't pretend with us. We're not that we're not going to play games with you. If you pimp your wife, if you prostitute your daughter, we're going to call you on that. And if your son is a faggot, and some of these boys are little faggots, you see that they put their legs together, they wear these tight stuff, you dress them like a little homo, we're going to say, yo, your son got problems. Maybe you need to take him to a doctor or something because he don't even know what he is. Oh, he's shy. No, that's timid. Timid is different from shy. Okay? Timidity is haram in Islam. The Prophet was shy. Okay? And he was in the midst of the battle. But he was shyer than a virgin girl in her room. There's a huge difference. Timidity is the inability to perform when called on. That's what timidity is. That's what's called a jaban. They call it jaban because that's the same word we use for cheese. Melt. Melt under the heat. He's not firm, just mush. Jubna. From jaban. It's cowardly. So we see this coming up and, you know, people say, oh, it's not good. Well, you know, I don't know what you think is good, but we're raising men. We're trying to raise men. We're trying to raise women. That means we have a moral stance that's not established by us, activities that are not established by us, that we believe are the best ones. And if you don't believe that, then don't pretend like you're a Muslim. You do not represent us. You don't represent Islam. We don't care what country you come from. Islam has clear morals and clear rules. If you don't adhere to them, you're a liar if you're saying you're Muslim. We're going to call you it right in front of everybody else. This is not Islam. Show us where that where we have interfaith in Islam, where you dance with your, you let your daughters dance with kufar men. Show me that. Show me where you bring your wife around without a khimar on and showing her cleavage and everything like that. Where this is in Islam. Show me Aisha and Khadija and all of them like that. No, this is not Islam. Care how much money you got or you think you got.
Nah. Sheikh. There's a question I wanted to ask for a long time, but I wanted to ask with Dr. Maisha here as well. Do we have time? I think it's related.
Go quickly.
Basically, so one thing I've noticed is that when we talk about the family situation in our communities in America, a lot of times we hear from the women that the life of a woman is really hard. Like when you're a wife and mother, especially if you have to stay in the house, like, and just do housework and watch the children all the time, that's actually a really hard life. And I totally agree with that. Like, I think.
No, I don't. I think that's an easy life.
Well, here's, let me be a little bit more clear what I'm saying. If you have your wife far away, if you don't interact with the community at large, and it's just one woman in the house with a bunch of children and there's no other like outlet for her to go to, that is kind of like the Western way of living, which that, like, I find that to be hard. Like, I think that's too difficult.
But see, what you're seeing it only in this later generation of it.
That when that's what I'm getting to. Like, this,
there was
this is my question.
Okay, like, go ahead.
Hold on. So my question, and this is for Dr. Maisha too, is when the women complain about this, right, being stressed out, being with the children all the time, having too much to do in the house, when the women see that this is difficult, why don't the women reach out to other women and network and try and, like, work together to try and, like, solve these problems communally? Why do they just stay by themselves complaining? I really want to know, like as a constructive question, why don't women work together more to make their lives easier in the Muslim community?
Can I go? Can I answer? May I answer first?
Of course.
Okay. What I saw happen, and this is why I got very, this goes back to what I said earlier about polygamy. What I saw happen was that we used to be like that. We were like that. We breastfed. When I was coming up, we breastfed each other's babies.
That's what I'm talking
about. We were always together.
What happened?
We were always together. I'm about to tell you. And if I had to go someplace, I just left my little, like, I couldn't take my little one. I left him with the sisters. One of them would breastfeed.
Exactly.
We all made sure we didn't go past 5 bellyfuls so that if they ever wanted to get married, they could. And there was enough of us that the babies could get passed around. And we all just kept count. Okay. When all this crazy polygamy stuff happened and they started pimping us out, basically, and using us to get welfare checks, it caused such distrust among the women like I had never seen, where you didn't even know if someone was going to divorce you and marry a friend, just like in the hood or whatever. Like, you might have a friend who's not married.
So the women stopped trusting each other. Is the answer.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. They stopped trusting each other because of all the games that got played with polygamy. And then when you talk about the Shia community, like in Atlanta, at one point, almost every man had been married to almost every woman. And like the amount of like things, I don't want to be vulgar, but the medical issues was ridiculous. Mm. All of this kind of stuff was happening. And, you know, men going and marrying a wife behind your back and this and that. So the women got very isolated because they didn't know if their family was going to stay intact.
Because
once
because
they would have two or three kids for a guy, then he would be done. He'd be done with it.
But this happens in communities also where polygyny is not that prevalent. That's because I've asked a couple friends I know.
That was the mentality that I saw happen and in different cities. I saw happen.
Okay, look. What Dr. Maisha said is partially the answer. The other part of it is preceding our communities. The kufr, and because everything goes back to Islam and kufr. Kufr promoted monogamy. Okay? Polygyny was practiced by everyone. All different peoples were practicing polygyny. Okay? Polygyny, not polygamy and not polyandry. And the different things that they do now. But the main type of marriage was polygynous. Multiple women, one man. And these were the strongest of families. And like she said, she didn't mention this, but she implied it. The natural inclination for women is to cooperate with one another. They are communal. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says it in the Quran. Zuyyina lin-nas. He said, what is made beautiful to all the people, Nas includes men and women, hubb shahawat, love and desire, an-nisa. So women even love women. Women love to be around and in a group of women, like-minded and cooperative women. And you used to see this in the church too. They would have different groups.
Exactly. I experienced that too as a kid.
Right.
Like,
these women would come together, they bake some cakes, make some food. They made it happen.
All the time.
The women did. But
we used to kick the men out. We used to kick them out.
The United States as a kufr system, the American dream turned into an American nightmare. So
yes.
Whereas they say we're going to promote an American dream, but they really promoted fear. And whenever fear is promoted, that's directly from shaitan. As Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, الشيطان يخوف أولياءه, meaning he spreads doubt and fear and distrust amongst anyone who listens to him, his awliya, or anyone who listens to him, who even gives him half a second. And don't say, إذا نزغ نزغن, you know, you say, أعوذ بالله. Allah says, if it scratches, if you sniff of him, if you even get a notion of shaitan, then you should say, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. You get any thought of evil, you should say, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. But we nurture these negative thoughts. We nurture them. And that's why Surah Al-Nas is so important, because when you nurture it, now you have picked up the argument. Shaitan just whispered, dropped the seed, we grew the seed into a plant. The plant of hasad, the plant of distrust. Mm. So we go back to monogamy. And I wrote a whole lecture on this one time, and I mentioned how women became the biggest enemies of women in the world, okay? Because
that's what
of their fear, because of their fear that they would not have suitable husbands or enough. So what does Shaitan do? He says, there's not enough men. He always cares this scarcity notion. There's not enough. You're not going to have a good one. Or he's going to take away the good from you when you get this other, and if he gets married to your friend, you know, and this type of thing or something.
But
Miss, let me finish. Okay. Now, I'm not talking to your situation. I'm talking in general to that because the application, the ruling comes first. The mistakes people make, you know, along that way is something different. So I'm not negating the realities that she said that men caused a lot of this distrust. I'm not saying that. I'm telling you what preceded even them even getting to that point. Because what was the origin was there was good men, and those good men had good wives and good women. And even if they weren't wives, they were working together in these type of way. Shaitan came and whispered into those men and made them greedy and then ruined and spread the distrust amongst those women's hearts. But this was an institutional thing. Prior to that, what the institutional mentality came down was that, hey, that's my man. Get your own man, your Jezebel. And she became afraid when she sees another woman who her husband might like, because she knows her husband and what he likes. This DNA is in her body. She understands him much more intrinsically. Consciously, what he likes and dislikes, especially if she's had children from him, right? And so she gets afraid and pushes this woman away or whispers evil about her to her husband so he could never even think that he was going to marry that girl, okay? Because she says something negative about it. And then this becomes the thing where women start hating on women and speaking evil about women. And some of it may be true and some of it may not be true. But it's not to be done, because one of the biggest sins, the seven mawbiqat, this is the way Shaitan tricks and gets everybody in trouble. By tricking these women to talk negative about these other women and to accuse them of being unchaste and having, un-Islamic intentions, you've just now done qadhf, thrown this negative talk about this woman. And Allah's Messenger said, this is one of the major sins, to accuse a chaste woman of having the intentions or have being a woman, a lewd, fat, you know, an adulterous woman. And that's what these women say when they say, oh, that lady, she's a slut. Oh, she's a Jezebel. She's a husband taker. She's a man eater. She coming over here trying to flirt with you. You know, hey, that's major sin. Destroying people's good deeds and destroying people's, you know, deen in this way. And so this is how Shaitan, and then Shaitan went to the men where those women were like, okay, I'm down for a position. I'm going to give it a try. Then Shaitan went to the men and told them and taught them to be greedy, take advantage. Good intentions turn into good opportunity. Yeah, I'm going to take them, become an opportunist. And so now those other women get lost in that thing. So it starts off with the real enemy, and that's Shaitan, with his doubt, with his scarcity paradigm, and with the greed and distrust that he's spreading around all people, so that everybody involved, not all people, but every angle of it. And then the government, what the government do? It made it very difficult for you to have multiple wives. You can add as many children as you want to your insurance, but you can't add your wife to your insurance. I'm just saying for those people who use it, you know, let's say medical insurance and stuff like that. And if you talk to most people, they'll tell you this is the biggest reason why they can't do polygyny. Okay, I can't put my wife on my insurance. I don't understand that. I'm 57 years old. I've had two wives since I can remember. I can't even remember just having one wife except when I first got married. I've never had this issue of insurance. You know, I don't have insurance, but it's never stopped me from going to and using any particular doctor. You get my point? So yeah. I'm just saying that these are fake things that people tell themselves why they shouldn't and cannot, and it's untenable. And other people say it's against the law, and that's much hogwash as well. It's not against the law. You know, when I went to federal court and they wrote in there, Abu Talib lives with his two girlfriends. I made a whole big stink about it and objected and had a whole, a session to say that they slandered me, okay? And that they need to change every document that they have my name on there on record that I do not have any girlfriends and I live with my two wives in two different addresses, okay? And the judge ruled in my favor that this is slanderous and liable. Hmm. To say that a man has girlfriends when he's married to two wives. The state marriage has never been a condition for the acceptance of marriage. They just give you benefits for it. Okay? Marriage has always been a religious function.
Always.
Always. It's not run by the state.
Well,
nor regulated.
Not with the rainbow people, but yeah.
Yeah, well, they start again. They want to do that because they want to see when you push it to the state. Now you've made the state a dean.
Yeah,
see?
That's
America.
What
Unite is a dean.
Yeah, that's
this is their way. This is no. What did we say? Allah says because you made them halal by the word of Allah, not by the word of the state.
Right.
You know, no, they don't have the authority. By the authority invested in me by the state of Illinois, I now pronounce you man. Why? Hell, you don't. Not me. You, I don't need your word.
Right.
Bismillah. But kalimatullah, this is Islam, and most people are ignorant of these things.
Sheikh, I didn't see a whole lot of that between Muslims. What I saw was the men going
to
the club.
General.
Getting a capper and trying to marry her or call her a right hand possession, and that's when I saw it break down.
What I'm saying
to you
is that
I saw in the hood with the Muslims. That's when the Muslim women were like, bump this polygamous thing, because they would go get these capper girls who were not chaste, who were Jezebels, call them a wife or a right hand possession overnight. We had a term for it, we called it midnight marriages. Overnight, without the wife knowing, husband just didn't come home. He was at the club. He married some kaffir overnight, supposedly married her. And now she's got a disease, the wife that's been chased. This is what I saw that broke it down. From a high theological perspective, what you're saying,
that.
Yes, that's true. But that's what I saw really damage us. It didn't, because in the beginning, it was like, what I saw was, hey, don't leave. If a Muslim woman came, she became Muslim or whatever. Like, if people were like, don't leave any woman without a husband. Like, everybody's gonna have.
I was saying that. Yes, this is what this, because this is the Islamic law. Islamic.
That was in the beginning, but it changed.
Not to leave a wife without a husband.
Right. Everybody. That was the beginning, and we were all cool with that. Everybody was down with that. But these men were leading double lives and getting people sick. Like some Muslim women caught HIV. That's what broke our unity.
No, but that wasn't the majority. I mean, when you come from the same place, I remember the same thing. I remember when they made a place down the block from Masjid al-Taqwa just for all the people that were getting sick. Okay? And I remember Siraj Bahaj's daughter, she used to, rahimahullah, she used to go down there and sit down with the people. And she encouraged me to come down there and check it out. And that's when I saw that there were so many women with hepatitis, because AIDS wasn't really big then. It was just now coming.
Hepatitis,
you know,
so, herpes, and HIV.
It was hepatitis.
So many
and
Muslim women caught those.
Right. It was hepatitis and herpes at first. And then the AIDS stuff started coming in because crack was growing in the neighborhood. I remember that. But I'm saying, look, in that place, there wasn't more than 30 people.
But I'm not talking about just New York. I'm saying
I lived in
Atlanta. Atlanta was the worst. Atlanta was the worst.
So what's the solution?
I remember the Mouton marriage things. You know, I remember all of that. you know, the temporary muta marriages and these things. And,
well,
and,
I mean, even know, among the Sunnis, where people, where Muslim pious Muslim women,
you on still their third see that baby, in the community now. You, we
on
call,
their third
you know,
baby
it,
coming up with a disease because of her husband going and getting
they,
some
they,
woman
they
off call the street.
They call it tossing the girl around the community.
Well, I'm not talking just about that. Yes, that's the that was the main problem in the Shia community. And then sometimes it would happen.
It's the same problem in the so-called Salafi community, too. They toss the girl around the community. And
yeah,
it's because these dudes are greedy. They want to see what the next man got. And they you know, sometimes I don't blame the woman. She wants a good husband. She doesn't know she's going to get tossed. You know, she believes the brother is going to be with her. And then after he gets her virginity or takes her chastity, he finds a reason. Oh, she's not this or she's not that. She can't cook. She smell bad. She don't got, you know, and even they talk bad about her private parts and stuff like that. And then they get rid of her.
Yeah, well, that's what I saw. It to me, the solution is like what we're doing. We have to really teach the correct way of the deen. And what I was starting with was, before the men talk to any, when you're talking about people transitioning from kufr to Islam, before you talk to them about multiple wives, talk to them how to treat one. How do you even, these men don't know how to treat one wife correctly. So even the ones that aren't taking 2, 3, 4 wives at a time are in serial marriages. And this is damaging the Muslim women. They're in serial marriages. They marry this Muslim woman, divorce her. Marry this woman. They convert this woman to Islam, divorce her. Convert this woman to Islam, divorce her. And they got a kid in each one.
Yeah.
And
then I don't really know any men like that, really. So I don't think that applies to me. So, but I'm just curious how to encourage the women to live more communally is basically my question.
This is how you fix it. You got to train the men first.
One second. Let's slow down a little bit. What did you say that applies to me? What did you say that, Mr.
I was just saying is that, like, in the community where, like, my friends are, like, back in North Carolina, like, yeah. I don't see men doing this, really, like around my friends and stuff, and, like, in the masjid. Just going from just serial marriages, just going from woman to woman, having these, like, shady polygyny, arrangements. I don't see this among, like, my circle, so I'm just asking, like, how do we encourage the women to live more communally and like kind of?
Okay, let me say something to you. I think it's because you're young, you don't see. Okay,
I
have been given, you know.
No. Don't get me wrong. I've been in communities where that was happening. So I have seen
I'm
that before. You, I'm just saying
I'm
in my situation.
Oh, I get his question.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, in North Carolina, where I was the imam in two Charlotte, Durham, and Greensboro. There are a lot more people who have secret marriages than you probably figure out.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
I was the imam in those three places, and that includes the place that you're in. Okay? I will be in Charlotte on Sundays, and maybe another day of the week. I'll be in Greensboro almost every day, and I'll be in Durham twice a week. And I'm telling you that in each one of those places, there is a number of men that have secret marriages, or they have plural marriages, and we're trying to figure, you know, stop this up, and somebody has gotten HIV, not HIV, but some type of STD.
Herpes is the big one now.
Between the two, and it's people that you would never imagine. We have people who are respected in the community who have Kafir wives.
Yep.
Straight Kafir wives.
Yep.
And they're in the masjid every day.
And in those women don't have the same standards as the Muslim women. So how can you be in communion with women like that? You can't. So the key is to train the men better. That's what I think is the key.
It's not manly.
Could be.
See, you can't say that you're such a man that you need to have polygyny. You're not man enough to do it in a manly fashion.
Yep.
Which is that you've satisfied your wife, that you are manly enough and trustworthy enough for her to trust you to get ahead and know, okay, not that you need her permission, but you do need her trust, you know?
So you're saying that the women, if you're a man,
why do you have a secret marriage? Why is it a secret? Yeah. You know, if you're such a, you know, an alpha, you know, and so why is it a secret?
Mm.
You understand what I'm saying? You know, these are the things that I struggle with when I deal with these guys. And I don't embarrass them, you know, because these things should be kept private, and we don't want it to become widespread because copycat. People tend to copycat, but you know, we do have this as an epidemic in the Muslim community, you know, alhamdulillah, may Allah make it easy for us, in this regard. I think they should train the men.
Listen to what I'm saying, Dr. Maisha.
I do think that there are sadly women who are pieces of nothing, and they give men pure jahannam, and they don't appreciate the men, and the men are suffering under these particular type of marriages, and a lot of times it's good guys, okay? And then we have on the other side these good girls, women, and they're suffering under these men who isolate the women. Even if he doesn't have a second or third wife, he just isolates them and tortures them. So I always wish that the haters would go live with each other and the good people just divorce and go find each other.
That's the big solution.
Yes, okay. Yeah, I'm with you there.
But I want to answer his question, Sheikh. For what you're saying is, for the people that you perceive as not being in that lower group of people that are just satisfying their desires and greedy and all
I
that.
I could be wrong.
How do you get the women? It's okay, but let's presume you're right. We're going to go with your presumption, right? Those women, those people, now, how do you fix the communalism between those women?
Yes.
For me, that has come from, for me, I'm a Sufi. Everybody knows I'm a Sufi. So in our community, among the Sufi community that I'm in with my sheikh, we are like that, the women. Like, I finally found that again under my sheikh from Africa, who's very strict. I call him like a Salafi Sufi because he's super strict. Like, I don't even wear pants anymore because of him. So we women, whenever we are together, we're all cooking. We're all helping with the kids. Whoever's married to whoever doesn't even matter. You can't tell who's married to who or who isn't married because we're doing that. And the only thing that separates us is our financial geographic obligations. So when you put the love of Allah and His Messenger in the heart of the women and you make them love the deen first, and the men are treating the women with dignity and respect, the women are going to go back to their fitrah. I look at it as mothers and children. When your children are still children, if you as a woman have your house in order, your child, I used to get so many compliments on how disciplined and respectful my children were. I might have terrible trouble with a child at home, but when we went out, they knew better than to act up because I was a real mother and I kept them in order. A real man keeps his women in order. And part of that is showing them the right amount of love. Part of them is showing them the right amount of respect and the right amount of discipline.
Listen, you said something earlier, and I want to throw that in here too. Okay. Because I'm a believer in polygyny as part of the solution. Just like you said earlier, how can a man learn how to be a man if he doesn't see a man? Okay. I believe people can't learn how to be in polygyny either unless they see it as well. You know, so
that's
just
true.
Like, you know, solving the issue for some of these men who are unmanly or effeminate, I should say, they need to experience and see men. Likewise, the community at large has to see what I'm going to call, for argument's sake, successful polygynous marriages. Okay, I think that is also part of the solution, you know. And I don't think that everyone should be blamed and put on hold because of the people who have done it wrong, and or the people who are doing
Agreed.
It wrong. You know, that's what I just want to throw.
Yeah,
in
we
there.
Agree. We agree. Like my sheikh has always kept.
All right, then let me speak to your husband.
No, because I'm not doing it. Like, if you want to tell my husband that we're going to be divorced tomorrow, I'm not doing it.
No, I'm
traumatized. I don't even want to hear about it. Like, before anybody, I don't want another man to come tell me anything about polygamy until they are successful, sustainable Muslim schools for these children. When y'all build that, when there's a standing Muslim army, then come talk to me. I don't want to hear it. But I do agree with polygamy. I do agree with polygamy as a solution. I am just past that point. I am too traumatized. I have gone through too much, but I do agree with it. And I taught my daughters to accept it. I taught my daughters, this is Islam. You have to accept this because it's going to be necessary, but you have to do it right. And I would show them the examples of it being done right and the examples of being done wrong. I will give them your example. I will give them my sheikh's example. But it takes a man who has reached a certain point and who knows how to give women what you just said, that sensation of trust that I have a place. My sheikh has a wife, Aisha. She don't worry about, she said, I don't worry about his other wives. I know my place in the sheikh's heart. My sheikh, even with his students, he knows how to make you think you're the only student he has. And if he can do that, when he got hundreds of students, thousands of students all over the world, but he can make you feel like you're his only student, imagine how he makes his wives feel. So that's the key, is to teach the men to me at this point, the Muslim men have to teach each other and take these young boys and teach the boys what it means to be a man. Take them shooting, take them horseback riding, do this. If there's a woman that doesn't have a father for her sons, focus on those women, go help them. The men all go round up all those boys of all those single mothers that came out of these situations. And when women see that, they will change. They will go back to their fitra. They'll go back to their fitra.
You know, the problem with that is a number of problems or challenges with that. One is these women, the majority of them are helicopter moms. Okay? And they've raised their children to be dependent on them. And so if you take them out, some of them, you take some of these boys out and they'll be with some men. One of the things the men will do is smack the taste out their mouth when they start acting like, you know, like something. And then the boys will be like, they turn into these little girls.
Oh,
and
he hit me. I've seen it.
But that's okay with us as long as it stays there. When we get back and he goes back to his mother, if we got to hear drama from the mother, then we're not taking him out again. You know,
well, that's where you need to have a sister like me, because I tell these women, hush your mouth. You want a man that's going to grow up and protect you?
We used to have that.
My boys got smacked around. Like, no, I will handle those women. Bring them to me, because right now, like, yeah. I'm hot to counsel. I've had to counsel a couple of women. I was counseling one yesterday. I said, you complaining about all this stuff about your husband. Oh, he don't provide enough. Well, you knew he couldn't provide when you married him. So shut up on that point. I don't want to hear it. You accepted that condition. Just be quiet. But I'm going to tell you something. I've seen your husband. If any man comes anywhere near your family and tries to test your family, oh, he going to end up in a box. So that's more important than whether or not who got the cheddar, who's bringing the bread. I don't want to hear about who's bringing the bread. You already knew that you were a bigger bread winner. What he wants me to do, yes, you're supposed to stay home with his child. So you decided to do both, so figure it out. I had to figure it out. You got to figure it out. This is America. Stop crying. But the rest of the stuff you're talking about, 3/4 of what you complaining about your husband, is him being a man, my friend. He's being a man. And then I give her examples from my husband. He don't say it like your husband say it, but this is how he say it. He said the exact same thing. So what I'm telling you is, I told her, here's the 3 things you need to do. Make sure he can trust you, whatever that means, because he's been burnt before too. He actually had a woman cheat on him. He doesn't even know if the kid's his. So lay everything open. Here's my phone. Read my messages. I don't care. Two, cook, make the house smell nice, and take care of other things. Do those 3 things. You'll be straight. And don't complain. Just stop complaining. Just go a whole month. No matter what he does wrong, just shut up.
No. You said too much short time.
So I will handle those women. No, not at 10 years, because y'all don't know how to act. But she got a kid. Y'all need to be fussed at least once a month. She got a kid that is, like, borderline. And I'm like, yo, you better get that in order quick. In this world, when they're with me, he's not allowed to even sit next to her. Go with the men. Don't even come. He cannot come over here with the women. That's the first mistake these women make. Why you got that boy up under you? Send him over there with the men. I will deal. And you are absolutely right. But that is also because you have some nasty things going out here. And they don't know if that's a predator.
You know what? That's part of what's wrong with the women. You know what? You know, I hear that. And, you know, I think that the Western mentality of the existence of something, so everybody has to suffer because it might be something. You know, I think that is, you know, when I was in the Marine Corps, I was a scuba diver. One of the things I did was scuba diving. And so as a combat diver, we have to lock out of the submarine, and go look behind the submarine to make sure a Russian submarine is not following us. Especially, this is under Rumsfeld, the jerk. He would say, if you don't hear the submarine, does not mean there's no submarine there. So even especially, when the absence of proof does not mean the absence of existence. That is such a kafir thing to say.
So no, what I mean is you have to find that balance. And once the women
wait,
feel
I'm lost. Could you repeat
balance,
that? I didn't understand
okay.
that.
The absence of proof is not the absence of existence. It's very kafir.
You know, what I'm saying is this, is that United States mentality is to suffer the majority for the actions of a minority.
Oh, yep. I get it.
Okay. So
yep.
This mentality that every man could be a psychopath, a predator, and this type of thing like that.
Gotcha.
So I'm not going to trust any man until I know first if he's a predator.
How are you going to even know that? Like, you have to, you can't. And
right.
I'm working
and,
with
you
the women
and
on
you
that.
Can't
I
hardly read. You're not even, you know, a psychologist in that particular field or it, you know, I think you're a psychopath. You know, I think women are closer to psychopathy than men are because they could scare the mess. I'm glad Allah made us stronger, because if women were stronger than men, we'd be punked every day.
Well, Allah right? has balanced it. Allah has balanced it. We have savvy. I'm going to call it savvy. Y'all like to call
it. Yeah, I call it insanity.
We have savvy, and we have the other problem is when men say, "I don't care about your emotions." If you say that to a woman, she will never trust you.
It's not
because
that, you know,
a woman
what
has
man
to
is
be.
Saying when he says that. No.
I do, because I translated for her. I translated it for her. I said what he's saying is he cannot be controlled by your emotions because they change with the wind. But
well,
at
not
the same
just that,
time,
it means that he's logical, and he we don't have the same emotional balance that imbalance that you guys have.
It's
you
know, true. We're very emotionally, we have some emotional disbalance, but we also have intuition. So men have to find the balance between respecting our intuition and not being drowned by our emotions.
Well, I
because
think that
there's both
you know,
are important.
I agree with it. Men have to be conscious of their wives. Okay. When I say conscious, just the different personalities that they have to be deal with. But I disagree when that men are giving too much attention to some of these other things. I think that
I
what men should focus on is being a man and being kind. All, Allah's Messenger made it real simple. Be kind to your women. That's all you need to do. Be kind.
That's what I'm
and
saying.
That
That's what needs
I
to get taught first because it's not happening. I see
listen,
it.
And this is why polygyny is such a good thing for real men. Because when, and for women too, to stop some of the things that they're going through. Because, I mean, as a person who's been in polygyny for most of my life at 57, I got married. I think I was 20 when I got married, okay? Because I remember I turned 21 in Japan and I was already married, okay? So what I'm saying is, so I've been married and in polygyny most of my life. And the few instances where I wasn't in polygyny, like maybe 2 years over here or something, maybe 5 year stint I went without, I noticed a difference in the interaction with my wife when I had more than one wife and when I had, you know, just one wife, okay? And it is totally much more easier for a man emotionally, for the man's stability and the woman, you know, how she's going to behave when he is in polygyny. Number one, when he is in polygyny, he has to be very kind. He realizes this. Why? Because he knows he doesn't have time for this. Okay? He doesn't have time. He has to be fair and with his time. So the amount of time he can spend on this type of thing is something different too. And the woman realizes that as well. So when he comes home and she's going to spend some time with him, she knows that if I waste this time complaining and going through and throwing these unnecessary, you know, emotional trips, you know, then that's going to waste her time because he has
but
to
that's
go.
True of either one. That's true of either one. I don't, I think if the issue,
no,
you're
a
different.
Man has more
you
time
grew up different. You're different.
Sorry.
You grew up, you're different. You grew up different. What I have seen is when they have more than one, they treat one well and they treat the other like trash. I've seen it repeatedly. I've seen it repeatedly. I'm just telling you. So you're different. And Sheikh is different. He is fair. He gives each one their time. You know, and if he can't, for whatever reason, he...
Just,
no, meaning he makes
them,
each one feel he makes each one feel valuable. I've watched him in effect as a student that's close to him. I've been in intimate spaces with his family that most students don't get to be in. I've watched him work. This is not how most men handle it. They treat one good and they diss the other one. If there's two or three, whatever. There's one.
Both my wives, you see, they're hanging out.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's what I thought it was going to be when I first became Muslim.
Yeah, my wives.
That's what I was expecting.
Are friends, they hang out together. They spend more time with each other doing things, and they support each other. The children for a minute be looking at each other. Which one is my mom's? You know, and then
that's how it's supposed to be.
You know, so
that's how it's supposed to be.
I don't understand what the benefit.
That's because of who you are.
And treating one good and treating the other one bad. Why just divorce her? Get another one that you know. Why would you keep a wife?
That's how you are. Not every man has the constitution to be able to even do that, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself says your heart is going to incline more towards one. So it takes a man who knows how to behave regardless of the inclinations in his heart. So you have to be developed to a certain point as a human being in general.
We need discipline.
You had a certain... You had a certain head start in life. You didn't even ever see a woman get mistreated. You didn't even ever see a woman get yelled at. You saw the woman yell and the man stay chill. This is a different scenario. That's not the norm for most people. Most people have seen their parents go at it. Most people have seen the man just totally insult and break down that woman. And then he goes and gets another one to prove to her that she's not worthy. Like, it's a whole nother mentality happening out here. It's not what you're saying. You know, if she says, hey, why are the lights off? I can do whatever I want to do. I'll get another wife if I want. And she won't complain about the lights being off. What? I've seen it. So you can't compare that. You got to teach them.
Issues like that, because, you know, again.
I'm not saying it's always. I'm just saying it should never be. But what I'm saying is you got to teach them.
A lot of people don't have issues with their lights going out. That doesn't happen to everybody.
I'm saying that there's the situations that are happening. These women have to show up at the welfare office with their three little Muslim kids with their keem on. That's shameful for the Muslims. And they all married to the same dude. And he can't provide for any of them. It's shameful. And this is what's been happening for 20 some odd years that I've been able to see. And in different cities, this is a Muslim phenomenon. Because what's being taught is, oh, if you be in polygamy, you're only a real man. If you're a real man, there was one sheikh, a fake Sufi sheikh, who was saying that you weren't married unless you had two wives to men who couldn't even take care of one wife. So the foundation that the man has to at least be able to take care of a family wasn't even set. The foundation that a woman should not be worrying about her food, clothing, and shelter. You want a woman to respect what you say, but she's worried about food, clothing, and shelter? She don't know if she's going to have a place to live. So this is what has to be taught first. Teach the basics of what's required of even just having one wife. How are you supposed to treat even one wife? That you're never supposed to yell at a woman. That you're not supposed to hit a woman. Doesn't matter how your day was. Doesn't matter what crazy stuff comes out her mouth. You have to, what are the ways that you deal with it?
What if she doesn't serve you your food right when you came in the door?
Exactly. Like, this is when they think they can smack her. Like, why didn't she serve the food? Oh, because she's trying to work and breastfeed your kid? Well, yeah, she's not going to have that dinner ready. So if you want her to have your food ready, make sure she has a maid to help her with the cooking and the cleaning, because she's also breastfeeding. And,
you know,
and
here
provide
in Saudi,
for her.
Here in Mecca and Medina, the maids wind up pregnant.
Of course they do. So this is the other thing. Like, I'm Latino. Like, ain't no woman scrubbing my floors. I'll scrub my own. Thank you. If it's not my child, I will scrub my own floors. Thank you very much. Because what do you think is going to happen when some woman is bent over scrubbing your floors?
Let me tell you, we had a situation where a sheikh in Medina, Yani, graduate from Medina University, half of the Quran, his maid, you know, he had the Russian married away, maid. He Russian married the maid. But the wife said, no, y'all. She put him on blast. That maid was pregnant, okay?
Exactly.
So he sent her to Uganda, out the country and everything like that. But the situation came, so I went to the sheikh and I asked him, I said, yo, you know, what happened? What's the situation? He said, look, man, you know, this lady is cleaning my house.
Yep.
I come in the house. She's been over in the kitchen.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Cooking the food. I go in my bedroom. She's bent over the bed, making the bed.
Yep.
I started appreciating her.
Yep.
You know? And, you know.
No maids in my house.
I'm just giving my wife money. She's going over to her cousin's house. She's visiting this people. She's having parties at the house. You know, she ain't doing nothing.
She ain't doing nothing. Nope. I don't, if it ain't my child, I don't need no woman in my mom or my child. I don't need no woman in my house to get a cleaner. That's a setup. So if you don't want to be a polygamy, that's what you have to do. If you don't want to be a polygamy, you can't have a mate. But that's where the communalism comes back in. If you need help, you tell your husband, let's get ahead and marry because I need help. This is what the what I saw the African women do. You need to marry another wife because I need help. I literally saw them do this kind of stuff. You need to get married because I need help.
That's West Africa, though. That's West Africa.
It's West Africa.
It's a little different.
I don't know East Africa. I know West Africa.
In East Africa, you get a maid, and usually the maid might be a relative of the wife, like a cousin or niece or something like that. Or it could be from a poorer clan of, because there's a caste system in the world. I just have to say it. There are
people
who have traditionally been servant class in every society that I've been in. And so if you pick a woman from that area, or they'll pick a woman from that for you, and she'll be a young girl, and she'll pretty much be your slave. And they don't mind if you get her pregnant, because they want her to be the mother of your child. You get my point?
Yep. Yeah,
wow. That's some next level family strategy right there.
It's family strategy. And so that's why I said, if the men are already treating the women good in general, there's going to be a lot more tolerance for that. But you got, like, when you talk about the Arab countries, those women have a whole different mentality.
Well, they're vicious towards the slaves. They treat the slaves. Yeah.
They're very vicious towards the slaves, they're very lazy. They don't want to do anything. They don't want to cook. They don't want to clean. They just want to spend their husband's money.
Let me clarify. It's not the African Arabs. I'm just talking about Khalij. And I'm not talking about Iraqi either. Right. Iraqis don't treat their women like that. I've noticed that there is a difference between the Syrians, Iraqis, and those other countries like Saudi and what do you call it, Oman and Bahrain. They treat the women very, very bad when she's a servant or a slave girl. And they do have slave girls here. The law here says if the man has sex with the woman, as I read to you from the textbook, if he does, and, you know, only where it's a problem is if she complains. And then there's no head because she is mostly a slave. She doesn't own anything, and she's under his control and in his home, and all her clothes, every food, everything she has is being provided by him, and he's giving her money. So there's some level of understanding there. The problem is that the wives treat them bad, not the men. The wives treat them poorly. And so the women want to get out of there. I don't know if you guys saw a video. There was a video online. Maybe you could find it on YouTube, and I have to go. It was a woman from Africa, a dark-skinned woman from Africa. She was somewhere in the Khalij, and she was helping raise this other Arab woman's children. The children were running towards, it looked like they were running towards their mother, but they just jumped right past her and ran to the woman.
Yep.
And were hugging her and kissing her. And, you know, they loved this woman like that was their mother. And I was amazed. Did you see that? Did anybody see that?
Yeah, it's common. That's there's commonplace. Multiple videos like that. It's common. And that's what the women, that's what I talk to the women about. If you want to have your husband's love and appreciation, men are very simple. Whoever's doing those things, that's who he's going to love the most, unless he's just a no good guy. And like you said, greedy, but a decent, normal, sane man, that's usually what you have to do. And part of our problem here, to also answer Togoro's question, a lot of us women, we have to be ripping and running the streets providing. Yeah. So you have to be ripping and running the streets providing because you cannot manage the family finances with one person working. How are we supposed to be communal? We're barely in our
household.
I'll tell
you, I got a solution for that. I beg to differ. I really do. I think part of the problem is of a man not being a man is the fact that we don't have this community. What do you call it? We don't have the community of men working together even to make finances. Look at the example of Gazi Otogro, since we're talking to Togro right here, or Sultan Togro. What they did with their whole community. Everybody worked together, and they had skin in the game and received profit. See, we think that everybody has to have this $10,000 investment to start. Well, if I had $10,000, I wouldn't be in the problem, right? Cash in my hand. You know?
Right.
So where's the guy that can invest $100 and watch it grow, or $50, but let's say he can, not even $100, let's say $1,000. We've got to make it something, you know, where he can work to gain $1,000, get $1,000, and invest that. You know, who's teaching? Yes. And this is what they're not being taught, how to grow their wealth as a community of men. And so once that becomes the case, then they will be able to have, you know, the finances to provide for these families. And then there's another thing that men have to learn, how to live amongst their means and have what we call al-qina'a, satisfaction. You know, when we used to go to upstate New York and go to the cabin and everything, I used to notice that, hey, if this is what we're supposed to do when we're wealthy, we're going to the cabin. But when we go to the cabin, there's no electricity. We got to find wood. You know, so it's just like we're being poor.
Well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. And that's what I meant when I said men need to teach. Y'all need to have classes about men being men. Like, polygamy should be the last thing on the menu. That should be the last thing on the menu. But I think the women will be also satisfied with that if they're being properly loved and cared for.
Right.
In every other way.
That's what I think.
And these Muslim women, they're not materialistic to that extent. The ones here. In Saudi, I can't tell you. The Khalid, I can't tell you.
No. Women I disagree. I believe that no matter how materialistic a woman is, it's as Allah said, الرجال قوامون على النساء. Whatever the man is like, the woman will adjust to her man.
That's what I'm saying. And I've seen it.
As long as that man is paying her attention to do that. Now, if she refuses training, then that's when you divorce her. But if for the most part, she won't refuse training because it's not in her fitrah.
No, it's not.
For her to refuse that training. And when I say training, I don't mean it in a negative sense. She's not a dog or anything like that. But, you know, I mean by that is she will adjust to his flavor and the way he goes about doing things, or she won't, and they'll grow apart. And then he has to allow her to go. وَمَتِّعُهُنَّ, you know, as Allah says, and he still has to provide for her until she gets on her feet. You know,
but 90% of the women, you got some bad women out there, but 90% of the women, if he is doing the basics that are required of a man, as the Prophet laid out towards that woman, she is going to fall. My husband is a Blackanese. I am a loudmouth New York Puerto Rican. I fall in line. Like, my house gets real quiet when he's ready. Like, all that kind of stuff. You are going to fall in line. Every woman is going to fall in line. It's our nature. Like, there's a few women that are just evil, bad. You just need to get rid of them. But most of these women, if y'all men get together, and like, polygamy is last on the list. Let's talk about finances, nation building, security. Y'all get that stuff straight to where our basics are straight. Oh, we're going to fall in line. And then we'll be free to be like, you know what? Hey, let me help my sister over there. I'm already cooking. We can just both cook together and make triple and even help the other girl that just had a baby. Because that is our nature. That's what we're going to do by default. So I 100% agree with you. But that's, to me, I'm so sick of hearing about polygamy and nobody's talking about how to talk to your wife, how to build finances, how to raise the kids properly. What's the man's role? What's the woman's role? Like, can we get that straight first? Because we just came out of not even getting married, right? Like, in the Black community.
I gotta go. I'm sorry.
The norm was to just be zannies.
Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh.
So, all right, Sheikh. All right, like, I gotta go too. I shouldn't have stayed. Assalamu alaikum, everyone.
Wa alaikum salam. So, jazakallah khair, everyone. And thank you all for joining us today on Outlining Fiqh. We learned a lot. Mashallah, it was a very good discussion. But let's not rush things. If hadith, usul, and histories are still partially clouded in mysteries, then refrain yourself from speaking, for what can you teach? To have little knowledge and teach is to cheat. Go back to the graph and the knowledge within. There are 38 chapters to finish. Let's begin.